I, Libertine, Chapter 7. Lance found him in an alehouse, in a corner away from the light, and hunched over the boards, both hands on a great brownstone mug. His eyes and shoulders were set too close together, his jaw too long, and oddly edged straight up the front of his nether lip, as if like a rambowed warship, a keel had been shaped upward to form a prow. He wore his hair tied back in a tight club, but it grew double-crowned and defied such discipline. His clothes were good, but he sat. He moved. He held himself in ways which held neatness in perpetual abeyance.
"Mr. Meadows, Mr. Evelyn Meadows."
Meadows slowly withdrew his gaze from the bubbles in his mug and looked up. And sideways, without moving his head, his whole aspect was one of uncertainty and suspicion. Any true student of Balthazar Gracian could see them clearly, like two great handles thrust out and forward. Lance grasped them eagerly.
"I know you," he murmured.
He slid onto the bench opposite, fixed Meadows with a bright gaze, and waited.
"I don't know you,"
said Meadows in a high, breathy voice.
"Ah, but I know you,"
reiterated Lance. He waited again. Meadows dropped his eyes from Lance's to his brown ale. He raised the mug to his lips, seemed to study some puzzling conformation of bubbles within, and then put it down again without drinking. He flicked his eyes up and away, as if to see if he was still being impaled. He was.
"Well, then,"
when Lance still would not speak, he wet his lips and said,
"Well, then, I mean, how? You know, dash it all,"
he added for reasons of his own, and urgently, as if he must. Slowly, Lance brought up his gloved hand. Slowly, he removed the glove. It was a theatrical gesture, which would have justified the introduction of a solid gold hand, or a mangled hand, or, for that matter, no hand at all, and Meadows watched it, fascinated. Lance swung his index finger in a short, swift semicircle, and aimed it between Meadows' eyes, which converged slightly to contain it.
"You," said Lance, "are the author of A Defense of Albertus Magnus."
"Why, I say, yes," said Meadows and tittered. "I say, you know, dash it all, however did you know?"
Lance knew, the way he knew where and how Meadows lived, what books he bought, where he had been to school, and how he had fared there, how well he paid his bills, and roughly their extent. Tradesmen, booksellers, landlords, anyone who would gossip, and virtually anyone does. As to the Albertus Magnus piece, Lance had heard of that from an amused old scoundrel who had read proof for the Monthly Review, and who was sometimes called in to filter the lees from the huge masses of submissions that lively journal received unsolicited. The editor had said this:
"Damn all, nobody's attacked Albertus Magnus, not since 1280 anyhow. This idiot Meadows read somewhere that Albertus had been called the ape of Aristotle and got fretfully ruffled about it. Good lanky, I wish the government would supply people like that with a bright purple stamp to affix to their work, so one would know in advance it should be sent back unread. Come to think of it, they ought to have a stamp on their foreheads as well. Did you ever talk to the fool?"
"A splendid work," said Lance sincerely. "Far too good for the times. Too early or too late. Too early, probably, one has hope."
"I say, I mean, hang it, what did you say your name is?"
Lance told him, ordered a pint of bitter, and had the girl freshen Meadows' stone mug. Lance, who had had old Barrowbridge in an orgy of research for the past 3 days, simply tossed out names the way one would throw cubes of beef to a terrier. This way, that way, Roger Bacon, Paracletus, Arnoldus Villavonanus, Vincent of Beauvais, and Meadows scurried about snapping them up, and begged for more, Phlogiston, Prima Materia, Aqua Fortis Est Regis, and the Philosopher's Stone. For Meadows, heaven help him, wanted to be an alchemist.
Hang it, I mean, chaps just don't think about important things. I mean, you know, dash it, they don't,
Meadows said after an hour.
There's no one to teach one if one's interested. Would you teach me?
Asked Lance. From the depths of his goathood, Meadows looked up at this dawn-drenched cockerel of stupefaction.
I just couldn't. I call myself only a dashed student, you know. Neophyte, what? Teach you?
I am but recently come into the light, said Lance sonorously.
He hitched his coat back a bit from his bewildering brocaded waistcoat.
The hunt for pleasure, the waste, he said sadly, letting his voice trail away. And then, but you must have had a vision, like seeing the Grail, and here you are, searching, searching.
And so the bait, the strike, the hook.
Have you somewhere where we can work, study, experiment?
Begged Lance, all awe and excitement. He knew perfectly well the answer to that.
Oh, no, not at all, now. I had a jolly little lodging in Hampstead, don't you know, and I had a bit of an accident. You know, Basil Valentine's three constituents, yes, sulphur, mercury, salt, as the basis of all metals. I think him wrong, you know, but I wanted to repeat his experiment, what? Starting batching mixtures, basis 12, you know, 1 part salt, 12 parts quicksilver, 12 sulphur, next batch 2 parts salt, 12 and 12, you see? Most systematic, beautiful even. What happened?
Smoke, said Meadows sadly.
Not the batch. That was melting nicely, though the sulphur smelt a bit, you know. I meant smelt. No, the deuced fire, mixed saltpeter and tallow fat, make it hotter, you know. Well, it smoked a bit, as I say. Landlord, well, old Stokes is a greedy bugger, who can always put his jolly old lid on with a florin or so. But the others, I mean, 8 houses round about, you know, all the silly asses running out into the snow at midnight, calling fire. Everyone so frightfully upset. And really, nothing was burning, just smoke. You know, I did get a bit muddled, and wasn't using salt in the batch. It was sal ammoniac. It really wasn't so bad. One could get quite near it by noon the next day. I had a sort of delegation call on me, you know, quite angry, you know.
Didn't you tell them it was in the interest of knowledge?
Well, naturally, my dear chap, but it seemed to make them all the angrier. I'd rather not talk about it, said Meadows.
He shuddered and drank some ale and shuddered again.
Long and short of it, I can't study there any longer. I've asked here and there for lodgings, but I do believe the householders must have a guild, what? That sort of thing.
He laughed ruefully.
Used to think it'd be fine to be known and recognized wherever I went, what? Well, I wish it weren't at this point.
Lance suddenly clutched Meadows' biceps, half frightening him out of his crouch.
I say, I've been casting about for a little place, a house in Holborn. One or two possibilities across the river. Perhaps a digs away from London. Couldn't make up my mind. This seems to make it up for me. Though, by heaven, suppose I took a place miles away from anywhere. No landlords, no neighbours.
Would you help me with a library and a laboratory?
I mean, to arrange it all. I'll supply it. And get me started. Could you? Do you suppose?
Meadows glowed like a charcoal.
Well, I mean, I oughtn't. I did promise Charles, you know, and...
Charles? What Charles?
Oh, my stuffy cousin. He's all mercantile and family duty and that sort of thing. Gone to Madrid. Something about cork bark and olive oil.
Made me promise to stay and keep an eye on the family scandals.
Oh, dash it all. Nothing's happened in that in a donkey's years. I don't see why anything should.
Yes, I'll come, and willingly. What can happen in the next 4 weeks, or six?
What indeed?
Murmured Lance. He shook hands warmly, and made arrangements to meet again on the morrow.
Good evening, Captain.
Good evening, Pendleton. Are they in the library?
Yes, sir, Mr. Beasley and Miss Axelrood.
And Miss Chudley?
Miss Chudley has not returned, sir.
Lance raised his eyebrows and shrugged and went into the library.
Here he is now. Good evening, Captain Courtney.
Lilith Axelrood was in green tonight, very like the bottle green which old Barrowbridge had once vividly described to him. It suited her blindingly, and he said so.
And this is Mr. Beasley, Captain Courtney.
I am most honoured, sir.
Beasley, who had two deep vertical lines above his nose and two more, one on each side of his mouth, looked like a schoolmaster on the very verge of a caning session. He towered nearly to the height of Lance's collarbone, but he so carried himself that to that height he did tower. His expression at the moment denoted clearly that even if the captain expressed himself as honoured, he, Beasley, was not.
How do you do?
He said rapidly, not offering his hand.
Will Miss Chudley be joining us?
I fear not, said the girl.
I think she's trying to avoid me,
said Lance jocosely.
I think she is,
said Lilith Axelrood, soberly. Lance shot her a quick glance, and she made a slight shrug, which indicated that it was nothing which could be pursued in the presence of Beasley.
Lance said, I trust her disappointing absence will not keep us from making our little arrangements. I hold her power of attorney in the matter,
said Beasley, in a chilly voice.
Then to horse,
cried Lance, and from his breast pocket drew a sheaf of papers. He spread them on the table.
Here are a copy of the deed of the place I have in mind, a description of boundaries, properties, structures, and accesses, along with all the freeholds, fiefs, torts, and whereases that anyone needs to take title. Nice little place, really. Modest and modestly priced. Belongs to an old little baronet who lives nearby. Eustace. Gregory Eustace. Good little chap.
Beasley regarded the papers coldly, as if they were made of matter which a decent man would not mention, let alone touch.
I think, he said in his flat, dry little voice, that the first order of business ought to be the suit in law which you have allegedly discovered.
By no means, said Lance cheerfully. I should very much dislike going into that, even to the point of convincing you and making it possible for you to proceed, only to discover that you might have some objection to covering this.
He slapped the papers. For me.
Surely it is not unreasonable of me to wish to make sure of my quo to your quid.
Very well. Very, very well. Let me see,
snapped the lawyer.
Feather front, Titian down, Strawndry name.
Where do you come from?
Demanded Lance, knowing from Barrowbridge the answer. Beasley peered over the papers at him.
Much Haddam Hertz, he barked. Why, sir?
Just wondering, Mr. Beasley,
grinned Lance. Over the lawyer's shoulder he saw Miss Axelrood bite her lip and turn away, covering her mouth with a handkerchief. Beasley returned to the papers, moving his lips as he read.
Barbarous country. Surrey Downs. Kent, all that. 1,200 pounds?
Lance regarded his fingernails.
Actually, 2,000, sir. One doesn't simply move in with nothing for maintenance.
Beasley exchanged a startled glance with Miss Axelrood.
You expect an outright gift of 800 over and above the exorbitant cost of this pleasure palace?
It isn't exorbitant,
said Lance flatly.
All those acres, the brook, the wood, the buildings. And I wouldn't think of asking for 800 like that, sir. You do me an injustice.
What then?
400 now? I wouldn't expect the other 400 and the case was concluded to your satisfaction.
Beasley banged down the papers.
You, sir, are the most...
Mr. Beasley,
Miss Axelrood cautioned. Lance gathered up the papers.
I really didn't have to bring these all here.
he said in a wounded tone. "I thought you might like a documentation of the reasonableness of my requests. I don't feel you want to conclude this matter, Mr. Beasley."
"Of course he does," said Axelrod quickly. "Please, gentlemen, surely we can discuss this without asperities."
"I am willing," said Lance sulkily.
"Mr. Beasley?"
"I wish to see the outline of your suit," said Beasley, with matching sullenness. "I will say that at the outset I doubted you had discovered such a thing in English law. My doubts have not been diminished. I shall not go so far as to say I will, without objection, accede to your monstrous proposal. If you can prove that there is such a procedure and convince me that it will succeed, I will consider it. I say this because of a new and, I suspect, unshakable conviction that you are about to be unmasked as a...
"Mr. Beasley!"
The lawyer, now all pink about his frozen gills, subsided and glared at Lance.
"You agree, Miss Axelrod. Not the scurrilousness. I understand and sympathize with the plight of a usual barrister faced with unusual matters, but the part about his agreement to my proposal, if the matter of the suit satisfies him..."
"Of course I agree,"
she said placatingly. Lance glanced at the clock on the mantel, smiled, and stepped swiftly to the bookcase, which held the law library.
"It's here, sir,"
he said, still smiling, and handed the barrister a book.
"What? What? Procedures and Jurisprudence? Court Christian? That's the... I beg your pardon, ma'am. What's this? The ecclesiastical courts do not cover a case of this kind."
"Don't they?"
"You see,"
said Beasley, turning to Miss Axelrod,
"this young... this man's bewildering performance is beginning to show a seam, as I knew it would. The ecclesiastical courts nowadays confine themselves almost exclusively to matters of church holdings and physical properties, hierarchical successions, tithes, and the like."
He tossed the book to the table.
"Almost,"
said Lance equably. He glanced at the clock again.
"By the way, are you prepared to make out the letter of credit here and now, sir?"
"Of course," said Beasley testily. "But I shan't need to."
Lance opened the book, selected a page, and handed it back.
"Here you are, then, sir."
"What's this? What? Good heavens!"
He read rapidly.
"Good heavens!"
he repeated, in quite a different tone, and looked up at Lance as if his opponent of a moment ago had quite disappeared and been replaced by a Lord Chief Justice.
"Whoever thought of looking here for something which properly belongs to the common law, or at least to the peerage action in the House of Lords? Quite amazing!"
"What? What is it?"
asked Miss Axelrod.
Why...
Beasley referred to the book again.
"Jack Dictation of Marriage! It hasn't been called twice in 400 years. Good heavens!"
Lance stood by the table, admiring his fingernails again. The girl tugged the rapt lawyer's elbow.
"Please, Mr. Beasley, tell me what it is. What it does, after all. I'm not an expert, like you and the captain here."
"Oh, I'm sorry, my dear. Appeared overwhelmed. This,"
he said, waving the book,
"this is a perfectly acceptable suit of law, hearable in the ecclesiastical court. A very quiet thing, mind you. Merely a consistory of three, in which the plaintiff, in this case Miss Chudley, asked the court to issue an order against the defendant, Mr. Hervey, to cause him to cease and desist forever from claiming a marriage to the plaintiff. It is designed, apparently, to keep various ruffians from claiming marriage to people of higher station, thereby gaining public recognition and credit, which is undeserved. You are right, sir. I see no reason why this is not applicable and adequate."
"Thank you, Mr. Beasley,"
said Lance modestly.
"I'm afraid I'm just stupid, but..."
the girl said.
"Understandable, quite,"
said Beasley expansively. He was acting like a man who, asked to sip vinegar, tastes a rare old wine.
"You see, when the court issues the order to Mr. Hervey commanding him to desist from boasting of his marriage, it is ordering him to desist from boasting of a non-existing marriage. By passing the order itself, it is at the same time accepting the nullity of the marriage. Its order is a de facto certificate that not the marriage is hereby ended, but that it never existed. Am I correct, sir?"
he asked respectfully.
"Quite, sir,"
responded Lance,
with a mimicry that passed right over the other's head and struck Miss Axelrod dead center in the recipilities.
"May I call your attention to..."
He took the book and turned two pages.
"This, Mr. Beasley."
"Yes, yes. Oh, dear." He turned to Miss Axelrod, who had recovered. "Is there anyone cognizant of this act of Miss Chudley's who might raise objections at the hearing? Say, one who might testify that in the past she has publicly acknowledged this alleged marriage?"
"Who might want to do a thing like that?" asked Lance blandly.
"Mr. Meadows," said Lilith, "would be delighted to do such a thing." "Oh," said Beasley, "he might not even know if such a thing has ever occurred." "Yes, Pendleton," said Miss Axelrod to the doorway.
"Beg pardon, miss. A Mr. Meadows here for Captain Courtney."
There was a sudden silence. Lance said quietly to his fingernails,
"We could ask him."
He looked pleasantly at the shocked barrister, the amazed girl, and said to the butler,
"Tell him I'll be out directly, Pendleton."
"Yes, sir."
"Why in heaven's name did you ask him here?"
hissed Miss Axelrod.
"I anticipated some delay in concluding matters," said Lance, "and I thought this might hurry things along."
"Mr. Beasley, hurry. Make out that paper he wants before that fool Meadows starts chatting with the servants."
"Oh, dear, yes." Beasley sat down on the table and took a cut quill.
"That was 12 up."
16, said Lance, "and your promissory note for the other 4 on conclusion of this business. Ah, don't fret so, Miss Axelrod. Meadows doesn't know Miss Chudley is in London, let alone here. I ascertained that."
"My, but you do take chances, Lance."
"I have all along," he smiled.
"Your full name?"
said Beasley, scribbling away.
"Lance, Captain Courtney."
"Captain? Why, I thought..."
"I try to explain that to people," said Lance tiredly, "but they all credit me with an army rank. I do wish I could change that."
"No doubt,"
said Beasley, biting his thin lip. What is the difference in that face, thought Lance. It hasn't changed. But now, my God, the old sly bird approves of me.
Here you go.
Lance took the letter and note and glanced through them.
"Thank you very much, sir. And you, miss."
"And you, Captain Lance?"
She laughed, then sobered.
"What will I do if you or Mr. Meadows are seen in or near London until the conclusion of this affair?"
"Why, I imagine you'd ask exhumation of my poor dead friend Higgle Pigott," he said.
"Just so," she said lightly. "I clearly recall where he's buried."
"Resquiscat et pace."
"Go, go," she cried.
"Not until I have invited you to my place in Surrey. Write me, will you? Have you the address?"
"Featherfront, Titsy and Down," she choked. "Go now."
"Good night, Mr. Beasley."
"Good night, young man. Perhaps we'll meet again one day. Who knows, there might be a desk in my office for a bright young chap."
"Thank you, sir, but I've other ambitions."
"Will you go out to Mr. Meadows?"
"My most cordial regards to Miss Chudley."
"Yes, thank you."
"And to Lady Blanton."
"Oh, you idiot, get out!"
And she fairly pushed him from the room. Meadows stood near the door, a brown hat squashed between his hands, and blinked at the attitude of the Blanton entry. He seemed to shrink timidly as Lance strode across laughing, then expanded again as he recognized him.
"Jolly people here, what?"
"Quite jolly," said Lance, and laughed again. "Thank you, Pendleton. Come along, Meadows, old chap. We'll have a tot of brandy in defense of Albertus Magnus. I think I've found the Philosopher's Stone."
"Oh, I do say."
They went out into the welcoming night.